Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
Make Money Mondays. Guest has spoken to us lots of times in the last couple of years, mostly about Burger King, but Hassan Adams is a multifaceted and a complex individual. And he's an interesting guy, and he's got a really refreshing approach to business. And so I thought he'd have a really refreshing approach to personal finance too. He's the chairman of Grand Parade Investments. He's one of the co-founders of Grand Parade. And I always sort of associated your naming of Grand Parade with the fact that Nelson Mandela first spoke there when he came out of prison after 27 years. But it's just so much deeper than that, Hassan. I mean, you talk there about people trading on that square of land outside the city hall in Cape Town for hundreds of years. In fact, it was probably the trading ground of the fort and the castle and everything else since then.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. Look, I mean, there's a lot of history to the name Grand Parade Investments. I was born in District 6 in a street called St. Philip Street. Did my first entrepreneurial approach into business by selling the newspaper, the Argus. I was an Argy boy in Hanover Street. So you know what, Cape Town is a very precious place to me, especially the center of Cape Town. And I remember the years when I was young. You know, the City Hall used to be the place where we had all the pantomimes and all these funny shows when I was a kid to go and watch. And the parade that is just opposite the City Hall used to be a place of convergence for all of our communities, where you have politicians standing on platforms like you have in London at Hyde Park. We had our own corner there for politicians, for preachers, and for trading on the parade. So it was an incredible place for people to be and to not only trade, but to listen and to learn and to cry and to hail the Lord, let's call it that, you know.
Tell me about growing up on St. Philip Street in District 6. People romanticize District 6 a lot, and and I'm sure there's a huge romance. There was ownership of land, and then, of course, the Nats cleared out District 6 throughout the 50s and 1960s. But tell me what it was like growing up in St. Philip Street in District 6.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, it was you know, District 6 was a place where everybody was family. It doesn't matter whether you weren't related, but you were family, you know. And that's how things were made to happen for everybody. I mean, you have from dressmakers to politicians to everybody comes from District 6. And my memory of District 6 as a child was when I came home one afternoon from primary school. And my mother and my sisters were standing on the pavement, and all of our furniture was standing on the pavement. And I said, "What's going on here, Mom?" And she said, "Look, the boulevard is coming." And we were forcibly removed, and I thought the boulevard was a monster at that time. So, yeah, so that was the start of understanding what it needs to be independent. We moved to my aunt's place in a place in a street called St. Philip Street, just one street off Hanover Street, and she had a two-bedroom apartment, but she accommodated us. My father was a barman. He used to come home late at night, so myself and my brother slept in the passage on one of these fold-up beds in wheels, and so I couldn't get to bed early. You know, you had to wait for your father to come home, otherwise you can't get to the bedroom, you know.
Otherwise you get stood on. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, that was the start of my career. You know, I had the night free to myself for most of the night, and being close to Hanover Street, I got involved with the guys who sold the Argus, and standing on the corner of where the Avalon Bioscope used to be. And one thing led to another. I landed myself with the whole run of the Argus in Hanover Street, and eventually also learned that the guy who used to do it used to sell the black market cinema tickets for the late night show. And he used to use the float of the Argus to buy these tickets and then sell it. And I did exactly the same thing until I got caught one day by the owner of the cinema, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm selling your tickets." He said, "But you're selling it at a much higher price than I'm selling it generally." So I said, "Well, you know, that's exactly what people want. I'm buying it up in front, and maybe you should join me, you know. Let's form a joint venture." At the age of, I think I was about 10 or 11 years old, and
Did he smack you about the head, or did he join you in the joint venture?
No, he was also an entrepreneur. I think he was just an employee there, and we ran a bit of a deal together, and that made it my whole deal risk-free. Let's call it that, you know, without knowing that. But I got into money like that from a very early age. I started to learn what business was all about.
Were you allowed to keep that money that you earned, that you worked for?
I must tell you a story, Bruce. You know, my mother was a staunch Muslim. I have a Muslim background. My father was Tamil. And so, my brother and myself were the only two males in the family. And when it comes to Christmas or Eid, we would wear the clothes that my parents has laid by, you know, at the shop for a year. And you get your little toughy shoes. I don't come from a very wealthy background. And while I was making this money one day, and I decided, no, I'm going to kit myself out, and I had a suit made, and I still remember I had a belt instead of these braces, and there I walked into the house fully togged up. My father asked me, where did you get this money? How did you pay for all of this? I said, I worked for it. He said, sorry, my friend, only I work in this house. And he cut my suit up, and he said, you're not going to show your brother that you're better than him. You know, we're all together in the same boat yet to survive. And it was the greatest lesson in my life. So, you know, that's what happened to my money.
That's quite a dramatic response, though. And many kids would have been cowed by it. Many kids would have gone, well, it's not worth it. I mean, why bother going out? I can play with my mates in the street. We can kick a ball around, a cricket ball, or whatever the case might be. Why go out and do the work if I can't enjoy the benefits of that?
Yeah, look, I think from an early age, I realized that work is what I enjoy, in whichever form it came, you know, whether it's trying to sell an Argus or trying to do what I'm doing now. I'm still a workaholic, you know, because I enjoy challenging new frontiers and, you know, challenging all sorts of new obstacles. It's just a way of life, you know, and if you get to enjoy things, it's not work, you know.
Well, I would agree with you completely on that point. Here you are, though, growing up in District 6. Eventually, was your family removed from District 6? Yeah. Entirely?
Yeah, entirely. Yeah, we lost everything. We're still on the list for our house in terms of the, the restitution or whatever they call it. You know, I mean, District 6 has been a disaster in terms of the real people who were, you know, removed from District 6. They're still waiting on residences and opportunities in District 6. But, I'm sure everything will come together. We've got enough other problems in this country to worry about.
It's been such an extraordinary process, and there's been so much infighting there, hasn't there, as to who owned what and who lived where. And now also it's sort of three generations down the line, and suddenly there are lots of cousins who might have equal claim to, you know, 20 square meters of land, and suddenly that makes life a lot more complicated.
Yeah, I have a very simple philosophy in life, you know. There's three events that takes place in your life. It's yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I think, you know, the most important event is today. Today is a consequence of yesterday, and tomorrow will be a consequence of today. So, you know, make best use of today. If I must worry about what happened yesterday, I'll still be waiting. And that's not me, unfortunately.
Well, maybe fortunately, because it's enabled you to create a business career, to break a pattern of poverty, of growing up. I don't want to say poverty. You had a home. Your dad had a job. Mum worked as well. There was an income. It wasn't as if you were starving as a youngster, but there wasn't plenty, I suppose.
Yeah, look, I mean, those years, everybody was called in to contribute towards whatever makes a family live rather than exist, you know. And, you know, there were very strong sort of family bonds amongst all sorts of families in District 6. And you hardly found beggars, and, you know, crime was amongst crime, you know. Gangsters were fighting gangsters, but not fighting the communities. And District 6 was an amazing place. You know, everybody lived together, irrespective of your race, your religion, your color, your creed. It was a wonderful place to be, and I can still remember it very, very vividly during my younger times that I had in District 6. You know, I still remember when we were removed eventually. My father, who was working at the Cafe Royal at the time, and when the owner died, he left my father a sum of money, and they paid him out for his share in the Cafe Royal, which was a pittance, but nevertheless, it was still a lot of money, and we moved to a place called Kensington, where we built the house. And I mean, simple little things, like when I was as young as 11 or 12 years old, I used to go and fetch my father's wages, and they used to clip it onto my vest, and so that nobody could see it, because my father, being a barman, used to come home late at night, and yeah, he was always scared of losing the week's wages. If that happened, it would have been a catastrophe. So it's those simple little things that I still treasure, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, did your dad control the purse strings in the house? I mean,
not at all.
He didn't want you to work. He didn't want you to show off your gains.
My mother was the matriarch that looked after the money. I remember that she used to put all the bits and pieces of money for the lay-bys, for the electricity, for whatever, in little brown packets. The sad thing is, when she got much older, I think she forgot where these packets were, and it became a problem. But it was just funny at the time, you know.
Yeah, no, but those are the endearing memories that we have about people who have come before us, of course, and their habits and the way in which they did it. We try to do things differently. I'm talking to Hassan Adams, the chairman of Grand Parade Investments. He's sharing life in District 6. He's sharing stories about money, his first jobs. We'll take it a little bit further on now toward the present day in just a minute.
Save the date. Cape Talk is returning to the Get Smarter Boardroom this Friday, the 20th of October. Get Smarter delivers online short courses certified by the world's leading universities, including HarvardX, UCT, University of Cambridge, and MIT. We'll be in conversation with CEO and EdTech entrepreneur Sam Paddock to learn more about how this recently acquired startup is paving the way for a Silicon Cape, and to share in the incredible stories of the individuals who got this company to where it is today. Tune in this Friday. Hashtag Cape Talk in the boardroom.
Mom! Dad, it's Rex. I think I have fleas. And I'm scratching like crazy. While you're out, please pick up some Bravecto. 12 weeks of tick and flea protection. 12 weeks! All the other dogs in the neighborhood have it. And trust me, I need it. Wait, is that a tick? Hurry!
Don't wait for your dog to beg. Get Bravecto from your vet. One tasty chew. 12 weeks of tick and flea protection. Zero worries. For more information, contact your vet or visit bravecto.co.za.
Bravo, Bravecto.
Ever wondered what joy sounds like? Now imagine what joy tastes like. Okay, you can stop imagining now. Bite off more happiness than you can chew with Bags of Bites. From home-baked rusks to scrumptious biscuits made from our age-old family recipes that suit your dietary requirements. Every delicious morsel is a joy to bake, making them a joy to eat. Go to bagsofbites.co.za and follow us on social media. Bags of Bites. The proof is in the tasting.
Romeo Papa to Tower. We've lost all visibility and can't trust the instruments. Can't see where we're headed. Never seen clouds like these before.
Romeo Papa, change course by 180 degrees. You have to get into the true cloud.
Oh, thanks. We're back on track.
Moving your business to the cloud requires expert guidance. One Channel's team of experts will unlock your business's full potential. One Channel provides everything you need, from cloud-based vertical business applications to feature-rich true cloud ERP like Acumatica, the world's fastest-growing cloud ERP. Go to onechannel.cloud to start your journey.
The Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
Chairman of Grand Parade Investments, Hassan Adams, in our Cape Town studio this evening. And what was your first proper job? I mean, I don't mean to say that selling a newspaper is not a proper job, or scalping tickets outside a cinema is not a proper job, but a salaried job, one that involved needing to pitch at a certain time and leave at a certain time.
Yeah, look, I always wanted to be an architect. So I eventually landed up working as a draftsman for a company called Ove Arup. And I was paid a pittance there at the beginning, because those years, you know, there was a big difference in, or disparity in earning as a learner, as being a non-white than being a white, you know. And unfortunately, at the time, we had to take what we got. I earned 60 rand a month. And that didn't even pay for most of the traveling, but I used to jump the bus to get to work and gave the rest to my mother, you know. So that was my first income earning a job. And after a month, I resigned. I said, this is not good enough for me. And they gave me an increase. And within 1 year, they trebled my salary because, you know, I kept on going, saying, I'm out of here. This is not enough. So that was my first job, and from there I obviously got the opportunity to go and study for a higher diploma in civil engineering, and I was the first person of color to get that, but it took quite a lot of effort, and so I progressed in engineering, and I worked for OVARP for about 19 years until I decided that it's time for me to start my own engineering practice, which I did with three other engineers.
So you would have been in your late 30s then?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. My early 30s.
What is this, 1980s?
It was about 1982, 83, somewhere around there. And we started a company called Ash, which was Adams, Seville and Herring, Cooper and Herring, and it later changed to Adams, Amai, Cooper and Herring, yeah.
And how long did that continue, that partnership continue?
No, that went for a long time. I mean, we became quite good at what we were doing. We were part of the strategic management teams also at the time of the transition in leading up to 1994. But we became quite a successful practice. We won most of the awards, from the Fulton Award, Concrete Award, to the Steel Award. And we've done some major, major projects and left some serious footprints.
Which one are you most proud of?
Yeah, look, we did the Maputo Corridor. We did the N4 Toll Road. We did the Sichikama.
So when you say big, I mean, you're serious about big. This is significant work.
Yeah. I was in charge of Saldanha Steel, you know, building that whole steel project in Saldanha as a project manager. I started a project management company. It's still running today, called ProMan, and I still run the engineering practice on the side. I hardly do any engineering anymore, but it's called Nadison's Consulting. So we employ quite a few engineers and technicians and project managers, and my passion is to leave a legacy behind there of training people, and we have done the training of quite a lot of people there. And I have a simple philosophy there. It's a naked in, naked out environment. My kids can't inherit any of my equity. It goes back to, you know, excellence in the progression of the staff there. If they grow, I dilute, and so I will eventually end up with owning nothing, and the staff will own everything.
And that is a very noble approach in South Africa. I mean, and that sort of seems to be what informed your creation of Grand Parade Investments, because it was community investment. That was the start of Grand Parade.
Look, I mean, Sun International approached me and four or five other people to start an empowerment company. And I used to be quite an active comrade in the ANC. I mean, I'm a bit troubled in saying that nowadays in terms of what's happening in the country. But nevertheless, there we are. Mandela was one of the greatest people I've ever met in my life. And I actually said to him one day that I want to give up my office-bearing position to go into business. And, you know, one thing led to another, and that's where the whole community process came about, where I told Sun that rather than, you know, just handing it to a couple of us, let's take it to all the communities. We went around, five of us or four of us, and going to every community in the Western Cape and raising 28 million from about just over 20,000 shareholders. Some of them didn't have money, like the women's groups in Langa, Wekwif, and all of that, but we organized the money for them, and we became a triple BE company without knowing what it meant at that time. You know, it's a term that's now generally used, and quite frankly, we didn't know what it was, you know.
Your life's been too perfect. I need to know your biggest money mistake. You need to be honest about this. The small Inyana skeleton moment of the show.
Yeah, look, we all have mistakes. You can't improve yourself if you don't make mistakes. You know, my biggest mistake came from my community approach to life. I had this vision of working in the informal settlements, and I built a shopping complex next to Brown's Farm, which was called Imarki, the market. And the idea was to involve all sorts of community facilitation because it was lacking in those areas. So I had the first community police station, the first deal with Eskom where we created projects like ElectroWise and teaching people how to use electricity while they buy, equipment for electricity, and all those sort of BillWise started with me. I created a company called BillWise with Bill.
Hassan, I'm sorry to rush you, but I just need to know, where did it go wrong?
It went wrong, horribly wrong, because, you know, at the time, there was a woman called Amy Beale that was killed on Brown's Farm.
Yes, yep.
And the banks pulled the carpet out underneath me, and they pulled the bond. And I lost everything. Sure. And eventually I took Standard Bank to court, and before we got to court, they settled with me. Because I thought it was highly unfair that they would do this to me. I lost the shopping center, and I sold it actually. Never ever been insolvent or liquidated or even sequestrated in my life. So I'm a fighter when it comes to, trying to get out of these problematic times. And that was my biggest disappointment, because I really wanted to help the community.
Yeah. And Hassan, we have to leave it there. I'm so sorry that we do, because you're such a good storyteller and you've had such a varied and interesting life. But we'll pick up on this again, I'm sure. The chairman of Grand Parade Investments, thank you for coming in. Thank you for sharing the stories.
Thanks a lot.
It just goes to show that there's no simple path to success. There really isn't. And it's about how you deal with the adversity, as Hassan Adams has done, as to how good your balance sheet looks later on in life.